GQ's Mad Influence is presented by Moët & Chandon. Life's memorable moments must be Moët & Chandon. Welcome to Mad Influence. I'm your host, Jim Nelson, editor-in-chief of GQ. Mad Influence is a podcast about artistic breakthroughs and what I like to call the long arc of creativity. My next guest epitomized that idea. Debbie Harry and Chris Stein are the heart of one of the most influential bands of the last 50 years, Blondie. Formed in the early New York punk scene of the 1970s, Blondie exploded on the larger music world in the late 70s and early 80s. While their sound was firmly grounded in punk, it evolved to embrace pop, reggae, disco, and rap. They had massive hits, Call Me, which was the theme song to American Gigolo, Heart of Glass, The Tide is High, and the first number one song to ever feature rapping, Rapture. These records did the impossible, bridging the underground and the mainstream. One album, 1979's Parallel Lines, sold 20 million copies. Who does that anymore? No one. Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Chris,
how are you?
They broke up, reformed, pursued solo projects, Jazz Passengers, an acting career, John Waters movies, photography. Through its different moods and incarnations, Blondie the band has continued to evolve, to stay curious. Their 1999 smash hit, Maria, made them one of the only two acts to have number one hits in the UK in three decades, the 70s, 80s, and 90s. The other person who did that, Michael Jackson. Their latest album, Pollinator, features collaborations with Dev Hynes and Charlie XCX, and the band's restless energy is there in every track, and Debbie Harry's voice still sounds as pure and soaring as ever. Chris's photographic work and unique eye are on vivid display in two recent books, Negative, Me and Blondie and the Advent of Punk, and his newest, Point of View, Me, New York City, and the Punk Scene. Chris Stein and Debbie Harry, welcome to Mad Influence.
The first thing I want to ask you, actually, is about the early stuff, is the question of influences. I think all great punk stories start with the New York Dolls, but I know you were at the School of Visual Arts, mm-hmm. Chris, studying fine arts and drifted into photography, and that you went to a fateful New York Dolls show,
yeah,
which led you to the Magic Tramps, which led you to meeting Debbie at a show with her band called the Stilettos, which I never heard, but I sure like the sound of it. But before there was history, what were you listening to? I'm trying to capture the stew of influence that formed Blondie. It's just like so bracingly different from all the music that came before.
What were you listening to?
I don't know. I was just, you know, listening to everything, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it wasn't like today, obviously, but I mean, I liked radio. I listened to radio, so I was always flipping the dial.
Everything was, you know, it was much more eclectic. We always, you know, it wasn't genre radio at that point, so you'd put on a station and it'd be the Jefferson Airplane and James Brown right next to each other, you know?
Yeah.
It was a different
thing. It was a smaller world. There was less music to have to, you know, look through to find something that you like.
I mean, I listen to all the usual stuff. I grew up with a lot of movie music. You know, people don't get what a huge cultural touchstone West Side Story was.
Really?
Oh, yeah. West Side Story was like, yeah, you guys are all too young. West Side Story was like the Beatles before the Beatles.
Really?
It was such a big deal. I must have seen it five times when I was in the period that it was released.
I would never have guessed that.
And you go to the theater, and when Tony dies at the end, the girls would be crying in the movie theater.
Right.
It was same as screaming at the Beatles.
Plus there was the Jets and the Sharks.
Yeah, the Jets and the Sharks, and they had the great suits and the jazz elements, and they said, fuck you, in it, and all this stuff, you know, where they maybe said,
well,
fuck you.
Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a Jet, you stay a Jet.
It was a moment, you know. And then shortly thereafter went the same route as the American girl groups, and the British guys took over everything.
Well, I always heard that, and I, you know, one of your first hits was Denis, and that had a sort of early 60s, and I hear the girl groups, one of my favorite songs of yours of all time is Shayla, and that sounds to me like a reinvented 60s girl group, kind of.
Scenery is still outside of me.
said once that you had a fantasy, you know, when you lived in New Jersey, that you spent a lot of time sort of imagining yourself singing. And I just wondered if you knew what that was, or did you have someone in mind? Was it Janis Joplin or?
Oh, no. No, it wasn't Janis. So maybe Janis later on, but when I was much younger, I think it really was sort of the R&B girls, you know, and that I really wished that I was black and, you know, I could, you know, have a girl group and so on and so forth. But I think imagination starts when you're young, you know. If you don't have it when you're young, you're probably never going to have it.
Yeah. Looking through these photos in your two books, I just kept thinking, I had read something where you said you used to come into New York City from New Jersey early in the morning or something. And I also saw in these books, before you guys became partners, romantic partners, it seemed like you were both in love with New York. You had, it was like another partner in that. And that, and what I see in those pictures are just a love affair with this city that was kind of in chaos.
But, oh, that time, yeah.
But Debbie, is it true that you used to take the train? I can't imagine.
I used to sneak over. I think it was like 85 cents, you know, to get on the bus. And I used to, you know, sneak away. And I had it all timed out carefully timed out. I had the schedule. And would walk from Port Authority down to the West Village, which is, you know, completely, you know, involved me very much. I don't know why so much, but years later, you know, I did a little play in Sheridan Square at the Axis Theater, and I would walk across. I, you know, lived up on 23rd Street, and I would walk down 8th Avenue onto Bleecker, and walk across Bleecker. And one day, when I was walking across there, it hit me that. It was like one of those moments of, you know, you get shot back in time and, you know, shot forward. And I suddenly had a moment of joy. I mean, it was complete joy that here was my bus trip to fucking Manhattan, you know, when I was a little scumbag, you know, little bitch, whatever. And then here I am, you know, I don't know how many years later, just having my dream.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic, fantastic moment.
Did you ever, like, actively hang out on McDougal Street? Did you go to McDougal Street, like, 65 and 6, all those years, 65,
well, yeah, 67? But I was working by then, you know. Yeah. I was, like, you know, an adult.
McDougal Street was the kind of the center of the youth scene.
It was wasn't it the folky area?
Yeah, folky, crossover into the rock.
Dylan would.
And Hendrix was stalking around. Dylan went electric at Newport at 65, you know, all that stuff. So.
I find myself, when I look at these pictures, nostalgic for an era that I never had. But that's the other thing, is that you said somewhere that, Chris, you were always drawn to, like, faded, dirty stuff.
Yeah, well, and New York decay. City,
and, decay, yeah.
Yeah, corruption. And,
it seemed like New York gave you that, didn't it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But, I mean, nobody saw what was coming. You know, nobody saw that. I mean, I guess there's some vague science fiction image of, you know, 50 years down the line, everything would be cleaned up and shiny and fancy, but I didn't give it much thought, certainly.
You mentioned this in the book, the first time you heard Blondie on the radio. Can you tell us where that was and what that was like?
17th Street is what how I remember it, just hearing probably In the Sun or X Offender. On the radio.
I do remember one day walking across some street, whether it was 20th Street or 17th Street, but hearing, you know her.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that sounds really good. What is that? What is that?
Hey, here she comes now.
Had you always had it in your head that that Blondie would be a radio band?
Yeah, you did.
I really enjoyed recording. I still like recording.
I think that that was really the goal for us, you know, to have things on radio and to make music that was accessible. We definitely weren't trying to be an art band. Even though, you know, both of us sort of came from questionable backgrounds, we could have actually done some kind of weird art project.
I'm thinking now about how as Blondie got bigger and bigger, Call Me becomes this big sensation. Can you tell me about how that song, weren't you given, Debbie, just an instrumental track from the great dance producer, George Moroder?
Giorgio, yeah.
No, it had lyrics.
Did it have lyrics?
Yeah. It had Man Machine. It had the title.
Man Machine?
Literal, weird lyrics. And Debbie thought it was way too literal.
Well, it was, you know, not something that I felt I could sing particularly.
Well, I think he just gave it to us to
map
out the melody more than adhere to the lyrics.
But then we went and watched it. So
we saw
a rough
American
cut.
Gigolo.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, what were you thinking when you put those lyrics together? What were you trying to conjure? I mean, it's one of those. It's like a timeless pop song, but you're also dealing with something pretty dirty. So how did you figure that out? I mean, you did it with the Muppets. I mean, it could be.
Oh, right. Oh, those Muppets are filthy. They've all got dirty minds.
You said you were referencing the things in the movie.
The visuals, more than anything. It's Schrader, really. It's all his fault because he crafted a picture that is so juicy and visual and colorful that the tonalities and all those colors. Actually, it was because it was done by Giorgio Armani. It was also the beginning of his real explosion into the fashion world. And if you look at the color palette of the picture, you know, it was greatly influenced, if not entirely influenced, by Armani. And so, you know, that really stuck with me. And that beginning, that opening shot when they're going down the US-1 on the Pacific coast was so beautiful. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know where it was happening. Could have been anywhere. So that sort of right away lifts you out of the, you know, you're just free, you know, gives you more freedom. And so that's sort of what happened to me. And we walked home after seeing it and it just sort of fell out, you know, just the visuals and, you know, what it was about.
In an interview with Legs McNeil for Please Kill Me, I came across this passage, Debbie, where you described a work ethic that might surprise people who thought that punk was just sort of pissed out. When you said, it was almost as if we were the children of the military, and a lot of us were, and we worked like military people. We had this drive and this obsession. The amount of work that we put out and the hours that we kept was absurd. Nobody does that. Nobody works like that. Why did you have to work like that? And was it because you thought you needed to seize the moment or it might escape you? Or
I don't know if there was a moment. I don't know if we felt like there was a moment while we were actually doing it. We were just all kind of crazed and wanting to do it.
Process so ongoing.
We had, you know, youthful energy. Ha!
Huh? Woohoo! But were you driven to just also keep experimenting? Because the music really does change dramatically from one record to the next.
Yeah, we were lucky to hook up with Mike, who was really open to all that stuff, you know.
Well, plus we were, you know, we weren't really schooled. And so, you know, we were learning as we were going. So I think now most people today that, you know, go into bands are accomplished musicians, have some training, some education, have a different perspective. You know, it's different. I feel, I sense now that there's going to be a new a little bit of a broader experience that's going to come out in music now. And it's, I don't know, I sort of feel like there's going to be a form that happens soon. It sort of already happened, but I think it's going to be really identified and, you know, it's going to incorporate a lot of different influences, but it's going to be really, really cool.
I wonder if it'll be local, because it seems like that's, you know, punk had a very specific time and place. And the only place to me where music now evolves or comes out of the blue is in, you know, places like Atlanta or Houston, where hip hop scenes get to evolve and really have the room. I always think that if punk formed now, it would be analyzed and critiqued and blogged about till it died or early death.
Yeah, well, no, but that was the whole New York downtown scene, was that it got to ferment for those years and before there was a lot of attention, you know.
Well, I think people taking possession of, you know, like saying, oh, yes, I want to own this. I want to be with this. I identify this is mine. You know, that can happen anywhere. I don't think it has to do with location anymore. I think it has to do with plugging into it.
You all did that early on with rap, and I wanted to ask you about Fat Five Freddy and me. The first time you heard rap, where were you?
We'd heard, like, you know, a couple of things on the radio. There was Rapper's Delight was around, and Sugar Hill Gang, maybe.
It was 79,
yeah. Yeah, well, no, earlier.
Freddie
brought us this thing in the Bronx.
Jersey, actually.
Yeah,
from Jersey.
Yeah, it was a lot of pressings, too. Yeah. It was like, you know, you'd get 45 pressings.
Bronx and Jersey.
Yeah.
I never knew about the Jersey. Seriously, I didn't know about that.
But then he took us to this event in the Bronx, and that was like the big moment that was like dazzling to us.
Yeah.
What'd you see? What did you witness?
A whole bunch of bands.
Neighbors,
you know, it was a big, it was a big local event. It was probably, you know, maybe only 300-400 people, but it was, you know, like the Funky Four and Flash and maybe Cold Crush, and a lot of these guys were later on Wild Style. And it was just great. It was an eye opener, and that was going on at the same time as the downtown scene, and I hadn't experienced it full on, so it was exciting.
Fat Five Freddy told me everybody slide, DJ spinning, I said my, Flash is fast, Flash is cool, Francois c'est pas, Flash ain't no Duke, and you don't stop, sure shot, go out to the parking lot, and you get in your car, and drive real far, and you drive all night, and then you see a light.
I love the video for that. I love the dude in the white tux dancing. Isn't Basquiat in the... Is it Basquiat?
Basquiat's in there briefly, yeah. He's the DJ.
He's DJ.
Yeah. But he was really pissed off because the director put him in front of this like pristine red wall and he really wanted to write on the wall. So he got like one little thing off and they told him to stop. So he would get cranky. And he was a good guy though.
There's a passage in the new introduction by John Ronson, who I love. He's written several pieces for us. He's a great writer. And he says this thing that I thought was great. He compares the punk scene in Manchester, which he says was rainy and dreary, and so you ended up with the Joy Division. And then New York. And he says, in your photos, he witnesses something different. It's a huge amount of happiness and fun and adventure and creativity and excitement and freedom. And I was glad to read that because I always heard that in the music of that era. And that's why I think I responded to it. There is a freedom, a sort of breaking out, but also a sort of joy in creation.
Well, the Ramones are so cheerful, all that stuff to me. I mean, I can't get past that. It's just, you know.
I don't want to walk around with you.
Yeah, all that stuff is right there.
Be more joyful than that.
Yeah, I want to be your boyfriend.
Even like Psycho Killer is very... upbeat and cheerful song, you know?
Well, very cheerful.
But much more, it's much more, there's joy and happiness in it, not the, whatever, the stereotype of punk is
no,
a
it wasn't
nihilistic.
Nihilistic,
thing.
Yeah. I was going to say. No, it didn't really go like that. It was very, really eclectic, too. I mean, from one band to the other, there was a really widespread of tonality and sounds and outlooks from all, you know, all the bands, us and Television, and Talking Heads. It was, you know, they were all very different.
Hey, I want to take a quick break here to thank Moët & Chandon. As you know, because you've been listening, Mad Influence features personalities and performers who shape our culture, focusing on moments that have mattered most to them.
We explore artistic breakthroughs and the hard-won discoveries that have helped forge legacies and define careers. The stuff, in other words, that's worth celebrating. So it's fitting that this season of Mad Influence is presented by Moët & Chandon, who has stood for celebrations for over 275 years. As we examine the ingredients of some pretty unforgettable creative careers, we're grateful for the support of the world's most loved champagne and for their encouragement to celebrate life's memorable moments. The other person I wanted to ask you about who seemed to have been close to you was William Burroughs. I'm a big Burroughs fan.
Burroughs was great. He was, you know, I'm really lucky to have gotten to hang with these guys. You know, he was terrific.
There's a picture of him with a rifle in your latest book, and I never knew that he was so into firearms.
Oh, yeah. You know, he loved weapons and firearms. Oh, yeah. And it was one of his main things. Yeah.
All kinds of weapons.
Did you shoot in?
No, it was kind of like a rite of passage with him. You had to go shooting with him.
Yeah.
If you were his buddy, you know, he would give everybody. I know a bunch of people, we all have these targets.
Uh-huh. Yes, I have my target.
Signed, no way, you're William S. Burroughs' target.
That are signed, signed by him, you know, with comments on the shots and whether, you know, it's a good grouping or not. That kind of stuff.
I did want to ask you, Andy Warhol is throughout these books, how much time you spent with him and what you learned from him.
We learned to listen to people better.
What I was going to say.
Yeah. Really?
He was a good listener. Probably secretly laughing inside. But
well, you just say, oh, really, was the phrase. Oh, really? That was what his answer to everything.
Yeah.
Was, oh, really?
I think probably the wheels never stopped turning in his head. Probably never stopped. And it probably started, you know, like when he was about 4.
Mm-hmm.
And his mother was very encouraging to him, and she was also an artist. She just understood who he was, and I think that's a really, really important thing about listening and understanding. You know, really, just feeling exactly where, instead of, you know, everybody, we all do it. We have this wall of protection around us, and you know, I think. You know, somehow she really allowed him not to have that and to be comfortable with it.
Andy was great. I mean, like the three people I consider myself the luckiest to have hung with are Andy and Burroughs and Valley Myers, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know who else is in that same category for me anyway.
Debbie, you said recently that the only place left for rock to go is toward more girl stars.
Oh, well, that was a long time ago.
Okay, maybe I read it recently. But you said there's nothing left for men to do. What did you mean by that? No more Coldplay?
Oh, I'm just being vicious, darling. Just vicious. No, I, you know, music is always evolving. And I mean, that's the sort of, you know, beauty of it. And the most important part of it is what, you know, each individual, you know, set of ears brings to it, whether
there's
it's
one thing
male
left
or
female. There's one thing left for men to
what?
Do.
What? What?
Apologize.
Oh.
Yes.
Dear, oh dear.
That's awesome. I wondered if punk was actually pro-feminist. Debbie, for you, did you feel like the punk scene was supportive of women?
Oh, no.
No.
Not at all, really.
Well, not when we started, it was pretty boys club.
Yeah, it was a boys club. But I think that the girls really added a lot. And, you know, so it sort of became evident and less, you know, I guess, frightening, because there was nothing really at stake other than to be interesting or cool or crazy. And, I mean, nobody was getting paid for it. So, it really didn't matter, you know, and variety's a spice of life, and everybody had a chance to get laid. So what more could you want?
I wanted to ask you about, Chris, about Debbie as a photographic subject. She's in all these photos. She's just amazing. She's been shot by so many people. And, I remember I said, you know, I think Andy Warhol once said that if he'd have plastic surgery, he'd want to come back as Debbie Harry. And Mick Rock once said, you can't take a bad picture of Debbie. But
well, if he had plastic surgery, he wouldn't have to wait to come back.
But you're the one who photographed her most and most frequently and most memorably. And to me, there's a grittiness and innocence in the early shots. There's a picture of you, Debbie, on the 14th Street Union Square subway that is just, and there's another one of the kitchen. I think it's about to go on fire.
Yeah.
Do you, I'm just curious about what kept drawing
you to her as a photographic subject and how that evolved?
I still am taken aback by seeing something. Sometimes I'll see some picture by somebody else of her that I haven't seen before, and I will still be like, holy shit, what does she look like? You know, she looks like that. I mean, it's what it is, you know? She just had this. I take it much less for granted now than I did back then.
Yes.
That's the benefit of old age, perhaps. I don't know.
Debbie, do you remember those photographs? When you look at them now, you look at the picture of you in Union Square, you look sort of like innocent, but also ready for the world. Picture of you in the kitchen with the flames. Do you remember each of them when you look at them?
Yeah, of course I do. And sometimes I sort of remember what I was thinking while the shot was being taken. You know, having a relationship with a photographer like that, I think it's sort of like being, a model for a painter or something. It's exactly mm-hmm. the same thing. So, you know, I was always trying to, learn a lot from Chris. I mean, you know, he was, really teaching me the ropes as far as, you know, being a subject and lighting and everything like that. So that was good education for me. It's very funny, you know, like, and there's a couple of shots when I look at them and I think, I'm looking at Chris with such affection and such love, you know. Yeah. It's phenomenal to me. I just say, wow, we had some really good times.
I want to thank you both for coming here. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Everyone out there, you should just go listen to Blondie albums all day long. Go and get the books, Negative, Me and Blondie and the Advent Punk, and Advent of Punk, and Point of View, Me, New York City, and the Punk Scene. They're great. Chris Stein, Debbie Harry, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
And hey, if you like what you're hearing, please subscribe and even rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. Thanks. Thank you.